This time on your weekly constitutional.
We found that probably 90% of the house was original and that we could bring it back to the Madison era. So in 2003, we started a deconstruction process. All of the woodwork and windows and stuff like that was saved and put in a big warehouse for us to look at more carefully. And most of the Madison stuff went back. So we reused, you know, baseboards and windows and doors. And for the little pieces that could not go back in the house, we have a architectural research collection of fragments, over 11,000 fragments from the house, everything from Madison-era nails to DuPont-era clawfoot bathtubs.
I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and this week it's about resurrecting Montpelier.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Jennifer Glass has one of the coolest jobs around. She's in charge of the continuing architectural restoration of James Madison's Montpelier. Why does Montpelier need to be restored, really resurrected? Well, because when James Madison died, Dolly Madison had to sell it. And over the next 200 years, it passed through a number of owners, each of whom made changes, perhaps most notably the DuPont family, which tripled the size of the mansion and covered it all with pink stucco. As of the 1980s, the mansion and the entire property went to the Montpelier Foundation, which began the very long and difficult process that continues to this day of restoring Montpelier to the 1830s apex of its Madisonian glory.
My name is Jennifer Glass, and I'm the Director of Architecture and Historic Preservation here at James Madison's Montpelier. It's a very long title, that's for sure.
Well, how did you get such an interesting sounding job?
So I actually started my career here at Montpelier during the restoration.
So you worked for John Jeans?
I did work for John Jeans.
And John was on our show, gosh, all those many years ago. Yeah. It took us around the house when it was being restored, and so you were part of that.
I was part of that, yeah. I graduated from University of Mary Washington with a historic preservation degree. And my first job after I graduated was an internship here at Montpelier. And then they offered me a job. And so during the restoration, I mainly documented things in the house, measured things, drew some and designed some of the chimney pieces and moldings. And it was such a great job, especially a first job out of college. And I loved it here. But then the restoration ended. And I worked for a architectural firm in Williamsburg called Meesick Cohen Wilson Baker Architects. Mm-hmm. Did a lot of museum restorations. Monticello, we did a few things there. Stratford Hall, a few things at Colonial Williamsburg. And then this job opened back up in 2015, and it seemed like a perfect fit for me. So I've been back here since then. And I was hired to...
Before we get to what you're doing right now... The restoration, you referred to that, mm-hmm. and those who are regular listeners will know what you're talking about, but others might not. Montpelier was acquired from the DuPont family back in the 80s, and at that time it was roughly three times the size it is now with two great big wings,
yeah.
And it was covered with pink stucco, and it was basically a shrine to horse racing, if I recall correctly. There was a whole room there,
yeah,
the trophy
sure.
room that's been preserved over mm-hmm. in the visitor center. And kudos to the DuPonts. I mean, they preserved a lot themselves.
Sure.
And those who want to go back, simply go to our podcast site and enter, I guess it would be architecture or John Jeans would do it as well in the search bar, and you'll come up with a whole show devoted to that. But just briefly, for those who didn't have a chance to listen to that episode all those years ago, it was a process, wasn't it, of sleuthing
yeah.
to figure out from the bones of the building itself what it had looked like back in the day, plus other stuff. Could you describe just a little bit of that whole restoration process?
Sure. So it started out in 2001, and it was Marion DuPont Scott's wish that the house be restored back to the Madison era. And so in 2001, they started what we call a feasibility study, and we had historians go through the house, and then it was the DuPont house. So like you said, it was about three times larger. And they cut little holes in the plaster, and they were looking for window openings and door openings. They would look very carefully at the doors and moldings to see if those were Madison era. Oftentimes, the DuPonts moved a lot of the Madison era woodwork, so they were great because they didn't throw it away, but they moved it into their wings. So we kind of had to go through the house as detectives and figure out where things originally lived and then bring them back.
You might find a board way over in one of the new wings, and you'd look at it and you'd say, yeah, this looks Madisonian to me.
Yeah, sure.
And then you'd actually go back and try to figure out exactly where it had been.
Yes. And we were very successful in most of the cases. So during that feasibility study, we found that probably 90% of the house was original and that we could bring it back to the Madison era. So in 2003, we started a deconstruction process and carefully removed those DuPont wings. All of the woodwork and windows and stuff like that was saved and put in a big warehouse for us to look at more carefully. And most of the Madison stuff went back. So we reused, you know, baseboards and windows and doors. And for the little pieces that could not go back in the house, we have a architectural research collection of fragments, over 11,000 fragments from the house. Everything from Madison-era nails to DuPont-era clawfoot bathtubs was saved, and we have that in our collection, so people can come and study that if they want in the future.
That's extremely cool, and it stands in really stark contrast to another non-restoration I heard of. I don't know a lot about this, so perhaps you know more, but when the White House was extensively renovated under Harry Truman, rather infamously, they just went in and gutted it and then hauled everything off to a landfill and then restored it, I guess, according to photographs or something.
Yeah.
But they didn't preserve much of any of what was originally in there. Just think of the treasure trove of information that was lost.
Well, it's interesting because early preservation efforts actually destroyed a lot of things. There's a house, I will not name names, but there was a famous architect that went through and actually took out kind of the 19th century fragments that we would today consider essential and historic, and he put back colonial revival stuff. And so that's kind
fakes.
Of fakes.
He put in fakes.
He put in fakes.
Oh, man.
But luckily, they had saved them, and they put them in a barn, and they were able to put them back in just a few years ago. So in a way—
When we're done here, I want to know what that—
Oh, I'll tell you. Yes. No problem.
Right.
But in a way, the early preservation efforts were more about restoring an idea or kind of what they thought the house should look like, whereas now, these days, we take a very scientific approach to restoration. And, you know, we probably saved a lot of boards and pieces of wood that people would say, oh, my gosh, why are you putting so much effort into saving this? That's such a waste of time and money. But we want, you know, to save as much Madison-era material as possible.
So when you're looking at Montpelier today, you're seeing to a great extent, to the majority of the extent, what was actually there. The actual bones of the building are the same that were there supporting the Madisons as they walk from room to room.
Yeah. Definitely. In the attic, for example, Marion DuPont Scott converted the attic space to quarters for her servants. Specifically in the garret, which is right over the portico, she made that into a room for her head jockey so he could look out the big lunette window and see the race tracks and see which horses were exercising. But in order to make that a nice livable space, she cut or had most of the support members cut.
Oh, my.
So the portico really wasn't attached to the house anymore.
I'm glad
at
no,
that
it
time.
Didn't fall on anybody.
Well, if you remember, we had a 2011 earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
If we hadn't restored the house, I think that portico would have fallen off the house.
Oh, my.
So we were able to, during the restoration, you know, structurally repair the house and put back its integrity, but also visually repair the house. So it does look like what it, you know, would have looked like in the Madison era. For instance, we have 37 original Madison era doors that were kind of scattered throughout the DuPont wing. Some of them were in their original locations, but many of them were not. And we looked very carefully and we pieced that all back together and they're back in their original spots. So
one of the things John Jeans told me I thought was one of the coolest things was that the old pieces of wood would leave ghost images.
Mm-hmm.
So you could look at a current piece of wood and you could see that there was something that had been there because the wood had faded differently there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could go back and say, I think I saw that board. And you could bring the board back and fit it back in. That must be a really cool moment.
Yeah.
When you realize, no, this piece goes here.
Yeah,
it's like doing a jigsaw puzzle.
It is like a big jigsaw puzzle. And there's actually moments like that. For instance, our surbase, or what we would call today a chair rail. So it's that molding that goes in the middle of the wall. Those were all removed in the 1850s by a later owner. None of them survived in the house. But we were able to look at paint ghosts, like you say, on the sides of the window casings. And it left a perfect outline of what that molding profile looked like. So we had that reproduced exactly and put back exactly where it would have been historically. So a lot of it is a detective work that we had to carefully piece back together.
So they're fake.
They're fake, but based on real evidence.
They're scientific fakes.
Scientific fakes. We just didn't make it up.
We did and if you'd had the originals, you would have used the
If we had the originals, we would have put it back.
Okay. Yeah. And if anybody's got the originals in an attic
yes,
someplace.
Yes, please bring them back.
Please bring them back. Send them to Jen. Okay, that was the restoration. Mm-hmm. That was the period when you were here originally.
Yep.
That was the restoration era. That's when you started here, you and John Jeans and your crew. And then you went off and did other great things. And then this job came open in 2015, and now here you are. And what have you been doing in the last 3 years?
A lot. I was originally started, I was hired to do the reconstruction of the outbuildings in the South Yard. So these are outbuildings that we had originally in a document from 1837. It's a fire insurance map that was in the Pennsylvania Historical Society. It was found during the Restoration, and it lists five outbuildings, two or three double quarters, two smokehouses, and those quarters were slave quarters. And then we also have a building that they found in the 1990s archaeologically that we think is the kitchen. And so that kind of started things out. So Matt Reeves, who's our director of archaeology and landscape restoration, he and his team found the footprints of those buildings. They did extensive archaeology in the South Yard.
Wait, I just have to pause here and say, this sounds like getting a treasure map and then finding the treasure.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, seriously, so someone goes up to Pennsylvania. There they are looking in these archives in Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania, yeah.
And they find an insurance map and it says Montpelier on it. Mm-hmm. And someone says, oh, I think this is going to show us where the slave quarters were. And so they bring it down and they show it to Matt. And I can just see Matt's face getting all excited.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes out and starts doing his careful archaeological dig thing. And then all of a sudden, clink, there it is.
Yeah.
He's found one of the foundations.
Yeah. So we were very lucky in, I guess it was 2014, that David M. Rubenstein donated $10 million to Montpelier.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For
could
us
always,
to...
Could always use more. Yeah. Could always, another 10 would be great.
That
would going.
Be,
okay.
be great. He donated that money for us to be able to put slavery back on the landscape through reconstructing these outbuildings, along with a few other things like our exhibition, The Mirror Distinction of Color, and also furnishing the house.
Very cool. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Jennifer Glass, the Director of Architecture and Historic Preservation at James Madison's Montpelier. After the break, we'll speak some more with Jen. Stick around. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. I'm speaking with Jennifer Glass, the Director of Architecture and Historic Preservation at Montpelier, and she's telling me about the ongoing process of restoring Montpelier to the 1830s, to the era when the Madisons were there and Montpelier was, well, it was its most Madisonian. Sometimes she has to build buildings almost from scratch. There are only foundations that remain, and that includes the slave quarters recently reconstructed in the South Yard. So once they had found these things, someone actually had to figure out what they looked like.
Mm-hmm.
Based upon these maps, based upon the foundations, I mean, that leaves a lot to the imagination, doesn't it?
It does. So what my job is as an architectural historian is I use a lot of things. I use the documentary record, so that would be that insurance map from 1837. I use the archaeological record, so the artifacts and the foundations that our archaeology team has uncovered. And then I also use, archives. So Colonial Williamsburg and the Virginia Department of Historic Resources, they have an extensive archive on historic buildings. And then we also go and visit surviving buildings out here in Virginia of the time period and type that we want to see. So my job kind of encompasses all of those areas. But the thing we start with first is obviously the archaeology. So that was really important to me. For instance, in our double slave quarters, the first week I was here, I asked Matt if I could see the iron artifacts. Because iron survives fairly well in our soil, I was looking for architectural hardware, so hinges, lock parts. I also looked at nail types and window glass. And nail types help us date the building, and then the other architectural fragments can tell me what it looked like. For instance, we found evidence of strap hinges on those double quarters.
Strap hinges.
Yeah, it's a type of hinge that was mostly used in secondary spaces like outbuildings or agricultural buildings. So you don't necessarily see it in big houses. We do have it in the cellar here at Montpelier, but you wouldn't see it in a finished, fancier space. Like, you don't have it upstairs in the mansion.
Again, that's what exactly is a strap hinge?
So it's a hinge that's like a long, basically a strap, and it sits on a pintle. So you would see this on gates or...
Okay, what's a pintle?
A pintle. Oh, man.
Using all these fancy architecture. I don't know this stuff.
A pintle is like a pin. So think about this pin that is driven into the wall or into the door frame. And then you have this strap, a long piece of metal that sits on top of it. And that's attached to the door. So when you were able to kind of attach the two pieces together, the door swings on them.
Okay. I'm not getting a really good vision of this. So I'd have to... go and Google an image of a strap hinge, I suppose. Okay.
Definitely Google it.
Okay, I'll definitely Google that. Okay, so you found strap hinges.
We found strap hinges, which means these buildings were mostly used as a secondary outbuilding. So slave quarters, it's perfect to have strap hinges on. You wouldn't necessarily see the nicer hinges. And the interesting part about our hinges are, when I looked at other comparable buildings in the county and surrounding counties, we went to Woodbury Forest, which is now a boys' prep school in Madison County. And it was actually owned by Madison's brother, William. And we were doing research for the smokehouses at the time. And I opened the smokehouse door and I looked at the back and looked at the hinges. And they are exactly what we're finding in the archaeology.
Oh, my.
So they could have even been made by the same blacksmith, probably an enslaved blacksmith here at the plantation.
That's right, because there was a blacksmith shop over near where the temple is, right?
Yeah, and then it moves a little bit later. So we do have a blacksmith here the whole entire Madison time period. And those nicer hinges that you would see in the house, those would have been ordered from England. So to see handmade, probably plantation made by an enslaved blacksmith, those type of hinges, that tells me those are kind of an outbuilding and not for the main house.
Understood. Okay. So based upon the archaeological research in the first instance, mm-hmm. based upon your research going over to the boys' school, mm-hmm. which was owned by Madison's brother,
yep.
you found something that looks exactly like what you found here. And so on that basis, you've got a pretty darn good idea of exactly what you're looking for when it comes time to restore the slave quarters.
Yeah.
And so did you actually have someone make new ones to order that are based upon those designs?
We did. We work with a number of restoration craftsmen, so everything from timber framers. We have a great cabinet maker and a restoration blacksmith who know these trades in and out and can use the appropriate hand tools and period tools to make these things for us.
So they not only make them, they make them the same way they were made back then.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow, another layer of authenticity. Mm-hmm. You said something before that sort of surprised me. You say that iron artifacts are well preserved in the soil here. Does that have to do with the chemical composition of the soil?
I don't know. I guess that would be a question for Matt. But for the ones that I've seen, if you have a thicker iron artifact, they seem to survive well enough for us to actually look at them and for me to get a good read on them. So, like, we found lock parts, we found keys for locks, and a very specific type of lock called a Banbury lock. And we found those throughout the slave quarter sites. So that tells me that the slave quarters had locks on the doors, which is kind of a myth that people don't think that the slaves could have locked their belongings and locked their dwellings, but they actually did. So we put those locks back on the door as well.
That is interesting. You think of slaves as having no private space, mm-hmm. but they did.
They did, yeah. And we found that through the archaeology. So we're really proud of being able to put those back on the doors and tell that story and educate people.
That's new information.
Mm-hmm.
That, in fact, that right there is the discovery of information that people didn't know before,
right.
or at least they haven't known since those times,
mm-hmm.
and now you've recreated it.
Yep.
How very cool. Very cool indeed. And I'm imagining that most of these artifacts, being heavy, probably were located very close to where they originally were.
Yeah, definitely. So we look at context as a big key for us. So, you know, where they're found in relation to the foundations of the building. A great thing that we look at is window glass distribution. That's a fancy term to say kind of where the window glass ends up when it's broken. And that will tell us where windows were in the building or kind of an approximate location for the windows in the building.
So most of the glass would have fallen pretty much straight down?
Yeah, very near where the window was, yeah.
Okay. So, wow. So the soil itself and the foundation itself is yielding lots of clues about mm-hmm. the composition, but you still got a lot of gaps to fill in. How do you fill in, you know, what color it was or what sort of wood was used? I'm guessing the wood's not still there.
No, the wood doesn't survive. But, you know, we can look at the woods that are used in the main house, so in the mansion. So the early part of the mansion is built using white oak, and then it switches over to yellow pine in the later kind of 18 teens when they're adding wings to the house. And that's a shift that we see throughout Virginia. This area of Virginia we call the Chesapeake region, and it has very specific architectural features. So if you come and look at the our reconstructions, you'll see that the weatherboards or the siding is beaded. That was a typical design feature back in the time.
Beaded.
Yeah, there's like a little decorative bead at the edge of the siding.
Hmm.
And it just kind of provides a little flourish, but that was on kind of every piece of siding. So if you look carefully, if you go to Colonial Williamsburg, you'll see that there. We're also using round butt shingles, so they're kind of a scalloped shingle. And the theory behind that is that it was to mimic pan tiles or clay tiles that were used kind of earlier on. When they switched to wood, they still like that kind of profile on the shingle. And you see those everywhere. And we actually have remnants of those round butt shingles that we found during the restoration in the attic of the mansion. So if I can, I'll tie things back to the mansion restoration.
That's my favorite new architectural term is round butt shingles.
Round butt shingles. They look like little fish scales.
I'm going to remember that one. Okay,
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
Okay, so cool. And so at a certain point, you said you had your eureka moment and you said, I think I know enough that I can actually give you blueprints for a new reconstructed
yeah.
slave quarter.
Mm-hmm.
How long did that take, that process from the point where you discovered the foundations to where you said, build it?
Well, for instance, right now we're reconstructing the spinning house.
Mm-hmm.
And they started digging, the archaeology team started digging that building maybe 2 years ago. And so I've had 2 years to kind of look at it while other projects are going on. And we started construction, I guess, back in June, and the frame went up just a few weeks ago, and they're already putting shingles on the building.
Mm-hmm.
But I take my time. I do all the design work and drawings myself. So I'm kind of acting as the historian, the contractor, and the designer, the architect. So things will change as I come across new images of historic buildings or come across a new document. I'll take that into consideration, and sometimes my contractors probably don't like it, but I'll change my mind halfway through.
I was going to ask you, Jen, do you ever have this moment where you think, I'm not sure I got that right?
Yeah, and but I have a great network of people that I work with,
mm-hmm.
Mostly people, you know, that are my mentors, really, that have worked for Colonial Williamsburg and other outfits and are experts in Chesapeake architecture. And I'll have them vet my drawings before we go into construction. So it's kind of a fail-safe. It's not just me coming up with ideas. We have a whole team of people that will look at the drawings, look at the designs, and tell me if they think something should be changed or point me in the right direction.
Has anyone ever really saved you from what you look back on you think would have been a terrible error?
Not really. There's little details. I'm a detail-oriented person, so I'll sweat the small stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll sweat little things like how big should the windows be, and I'll go to my mentors and just be like, oh, I'm not sure how this should be. And they'll be like, no, don't worry about it. It looks fine. So it's those little things, but sometimes they will help me along, door placement. They'll tell me, for instance, for the spinning house, one of the ideas was that this building started out in the 18th century and started out as a spinning house. So they were manufacturing fabric. And then in the early 19th century, when Madison, Jr., President Madison, owns the plantation, he turns it into a slave quarter. But because it starts out as this earlier building, we kind of have to take into consideration that its earlier function was for spinning. And when I talked to the historians, they thought that the first floor should only have one entrance and should be able to be locked separately because there'd be expensive things like yarn and textiles stored in that building. And then upstairs, there could be a separate entrance for a loft for slave quarters. And so they pointed me, I'll have this idea of what I want to do, but I might not have a great precedent for it. So they'll point me in the right direction and say, oh, you need to go, for instance, to Cherry Walk in Essex County. It's a surviving building that has a very similar setup to what you see and go and take a look at that and get the details from that. So we visited a lot of surviving buildings throughout Virginia to get ideas for this one.
And I'm going to take a wild guess that when you visit a building, it's not like when I visit a building. You bring along your tape measure and your digital camera, and everything is, as you say, details, right?
Yeah, it's all about the details. So I'll bring my tape measure, like you said. I'll bring molding combs so we can get molding profiles.
Molding combs.
Yeah, it's just this like little tool that you can use to get the contours of moldings and get them pretty exact. So we'll use that. Photos are huge for us. And I have a whole team that will go with me, and we'll measure stuff. We'll measure things like how wide are the doors, how tall are the doors, what kind of wood are they using, what's the nails type, what kind of treatment is it? Is it painted? And we'll just kind of go through that and make a whole list of things that we need to look at. And I'll take that into consideration when I'm designing these buildings.
It just occurs to me that you've got to have some sort of emotional reaction in your line of work. Simply looking around the landscape and seeing all the buildings that are falling into disrepair and all of the architectural knowledge that is just gradually fading into the landscape around us.
Yeah, it's hard sometimes.
Yeah, I would think it would be.
It's hard.
Right here in Montpelier, I mean, there are DuPont-era houses mm-hmm. that, for whatever reason, maybe it's lack of funds or maybe they weren't particularly significant,
yeah,
they're falling into disrepair, whereas
yep.
others nearby have been restored.
Yeah.
And I always feel a little bit of regret when I see that some things are not being preserved. And
yeah.
that's no criticism. It's just you drive down the highway, you see all the old barns falling into the ground. Well, that's a part
yeah.
of our history. It's disappearing in front of our eyes.
Exactly. I think part of it is that people don't realize what they have.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is, again, funds. You know, maintaining historic buildings is really tough and expensive. And
yes.
you need to know the right people to do the right work. So I understand that, and I get the, homeowners, they have to live in these buildings, so of course they're going to want bathrooms and kitchens, and so they're going to have to modify buildings. But yeah, it is sad sometimes to go in this building and think, oh my gosh, I don't know if this building's going to be here the next time I drive by. So that is kind of tough for us.
Well, I bet it is.
But it's good because we're documenting it, so we're at least, you know, getting photos of it and drawings, so it will live on through our research in a way.
It will. It will. It's sometimes just striking to look out on any given landscape and think how different it was 50 or 100 or 200 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we've frequently commented that so much of the viewshed has been preserved here at Montpelier, but so much of it has changed as well, and you're part of that process. Okay. So you've done the reconstructed slave quarters and now the reconstructed spinning house,
mm-hmm.
right? That's under process. Now,
yeah.
is the south yard almost finished?
So after the spinning house is done, we'll have one more building to do as part of the Rubenstein donation. And that's actually a really special building because we thought at first it was the kitchen. But after looking at it and talking to these historians that I look up to, they came out and took a look at it. It was kind of my idea that maybe this didn't start out as a kitchen, but maybe it started out as a house. And now we actually think it might have been Madison's boyhood home, that he might have grown up in this house for a few years until the mansion was built. And then it was converted into an outbuilding, and then probably in 1810 it was converted to a kitchen.
Okay, wait just a second. I got to get this straight.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't Madison grow up nearby?
Yeah, he...
Okay.
So
that was like a mile away, right?
Well, it was less than a mile. It's kind okay. of in front of our visitor center.
Right.
So that was always the theory, that he grew up at Mount Pleasant, which
right.
is where his father grew up, and his grandmother owned that part of land, and it's still part of Montpelier. It's kind of where our cemetery is located.
Yes, right near the cemetery. Okay,
mm-hmm.
But apparently the theory's changed.
Yeah, so when I looked at this house, this building... I was kind of confused at first because this building is really well preserved. We have a full foundation and full chimney base, and it looks very different than the other ones we're finding. So the brickwork is different. It's Flemish bond, which is an earlier brick pattern. You see that in the 18th century. And it has what we call a brick end. So one end of the building was all brick and the rest of it was frame or wood. There's a great building on the Eastern Shore that we just visited called Pear Valley. It's about the same time period. It's 1740. It also has a brick end. And it starts out as kind of a one-room planter's cottage. So if you think about this, Madison's parents are marrying in 1749. Madison's born in 1751. And his grandmother, who owns all of Montpelier at the time, is still alive. And our theory is that maybe his parents, you know, his mother is bringing 8 enslaved individuals to Montpelier as part of her wedding dowry, that maybe they're building their own little homestead away from his mother, his grandmother, Madison's grandmother.
Understandable.
And kind of starting their life a little bit, you know, separated from the earlier generations. And when I looked at this building...
So that's what you're discovering now.
Yeah.
So here, a little bit less than a mile away,
mm-hmm.
right near the site of the current mansion,
mm-hmm.
you've got something there that might actually have been where Madison grew up.
Yeah. And again...
Now that's a heck of a find.
It is.
I mean, that really changes
the story.
The whole narrative of this place.
Yeah.
I don't want to get too excited, but that's a big deal.
It is a big deal.
And you're figuring that out. This is you?
Yeah. Well, I have a lot of help, but that was one of my theories. And I was kind of shocked when I brought in these eminent architectural historians and they said, oh, yeah, I think you're on the right track.
Zowie, that must have been a eureka moment.
It was a eureka moment.
Do you remember where you were and what you were doing? You said, I think this might have been where Jemmy grew up.
Well, I kept looking at the archaeology and photos, and I was like, oh, this looks like this brickwork here is really thick. Why is this one wall really thick and not the rest of them? And then I started thinking about brick-ended buildings, which are pretty rare in Virginia. And that got me thinking, oh, my gosh, I've never seen a brick-ended outbuilding before. I don't think that's a thing. You only see brick-ended houses. And why would there be a house here, and why would it be this early? And then I looked at documents, and there are documents from Madison Sr. talking about building window and door sills and buying a house bell and having plank or, you know, wooden boards milled. And that sure seemed like they were building something. And so I think this building might be as early as 1750, and I think they lived in it until the mansion was built in about 1765.
Very interesting indeed. Now, let's go back one step, if we may.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you have a brick-end building to begin with?
So these are these little one-room houses are called planners' cottages, and for that time period, you know, a lot of the houses are very small. So this is only 16 by 20. So there's only, you know, limited space for them to kind of decorate, in a way, their house. And so it becomes kind of an ornamental feature.
So the bricks are just there for looks.
It's for looks, but it's also structural in a bit because you have a huge fireplace.
Okay, so this is where the chimney goes.
It's where the chimney goes, yeah. So
okay. There's
a big fireplace. And in the brick ends, you'll often see what are called glazed headers. So they're the bricks that you see. Sometimes they have like a glaze, you know, like for pottery. Mm-hmm. It's a glass-like finish on them. And they'll use those special bricks to do patterns in the brickwork. So we're going to maybe think about doing something like that as well, because we're finding those glazed bricks in the archaeology.
I'm working on a building. I'm working on a building. I'm working on a building for my Lord, for my Lord. It's a Holy Ghost building, it's a Holy Ghost building. It's a Holy Ghost building for my Lord, for my Lord.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. My guest this week is Jennifer Glass, the Director of Architecture and Historic Preservation at Montpelier. Isn't that a cool job? It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. This week I'm speaking with Jennifer Glass, who's in charge of restoring the architectural landscape at Montpelier. And she was just telling me a really remarkable story. She was restoring what she thought was one type of building in the South Yard, where the slave quarters have recently been restored. And it occurred to her that it didn't look right, that maybe this was something more. And now the leading theory is that this building, which was later converted to other uses, actually began life as a starter home for James Madison Sr. and his wife. That is, Jemmy's father came over to live in this building while the big mansion was being constructed, and it may very well have been where young Jemmy Jr., our James Madison, grew up.
So it's not big.
Not big. Mm-mm.
It's not designed to be the end-all and the be-all. I mean, they're thinking maybe already about doing the mansion.
Right.
But this is a place for Jemmy's family to live for a few years.
Yeah.
Right there, sort of being able to supervise the construction of the mansion.
Yeah, and we know that right when Frances Madison, who is President Madison's grandmother, when she dies, that's when the construction of the mansion starts. So I think that this house was sort of just a starter home for them. In a way, it seems like they wanted to resit the seat of the plantation. So where the mansion is now has, you know, beautiful sweeping views of the mountains, and it's kind of on a high spot in the property, whereas Mount Pleasant, where Frances Madison lived and started the plantation, that's kind of in a low spot, and it's a little bit further away. So this seems to be the area where James Madison's parents really wanted to settle, and they started there with this little house.
Well, congratulations on your groundbreaking theory, no pun intended. Very, very interesting stuff. That's what you've been doing, but you never seem to stop. And so you've got some other major plans coming up, don't you, for this coming January of 2019?
We do. So the other part of my job is to maintain and preserve our buildings, especially the mansion and the temple. Those are the only two Madison buildings that survive on the property. So every January, we close down the house for 2 weeks, the first 2 weeks of the month, and we do deep cleaning. Our collections and curatorial department, they're in charge of all the objects and furniture in the house. So they'll go through and they'll clean their stuff, and we'll go through and we'll start looking for areas that we need to repair or clean. So for instance, last year we did a lot of plaster repairs and lime wash. So lime wash is sort of a paint that's made from lime, and you put it over the plaster and it makes it kind of a white fine finish. So we often have to go back through, and it gets dirty really easily. So we'll go back through and we'll lime wash walls. We also do a lot of hardware maintenance. So we use all of the locks in the house are reproductions. None of the Madison era locks survived, unfortunately. But these, they're made to the same standards as the old locks. So they're kind of, they have skeleton keys and they seize up often. Sometimes we'll go in and you'll find, you know, a nest of ladybugs or stink bugs. And so they have to be maintained. So we'll go through and we'll check all the locks. If there's any that are sticking or not working properly, we'll take them off the doors. I'll kind of go through, take them apart, and clean them.
A nest of stink bugs.
Oh, it's happened before.
You found a nest of stink bugs
in
big old-fashioned lock.
In big old-fashioned.
Talked about some of the high points of your job. That must have been among the low points.
You know, I feel like it's a high point because I get to extract these insects and fix the lock. But, yeah, it's not so fun sometimes. And, you know, we have to clean walls. We have to touch up paint. So there's a lot that goes into maintaining these old houses, and we're very lucky that we can close down for 2 weeks every year just to get in there and really hit it hard and make sure everything looks pristine for our visitors.
Then after January and after this next building in the South Yard is fully reconstructed, what then? Are you working yourself out of a job?
No, I still have some projects, thankfully. Uh-huh. The next thing will probably be the temple. So,
The temples, there's already been a lot of work done.
There's been
that.
A lot of work, but we kind of ran out of money.
Ah, okay.
David,
we need a few million more.
So that's the thing with my job is, you know, we're dependent. We're a nonprofit. We're a museum. We're dependent on, you know, raising funds for these buildings to care for them. And we were very lucky. In 2015, we got a $500,000 donation from Forrest Mars, who, you know, Mars Candy.
Oh, yes. I've met a couple of the Mars family members. Mm-hmm. They were here.
Yeah, and they're really great philanthropists. They, you know, donate all across for historic causes. And that enabled us to kind of investigate the temple. The temple is the only other Madison building on site that survives, and it was built around 1810.
Now, before we go on there, I mean, that's probably striking a strange chord with some people. The mansion, which is what you see when you Google Montpelier and you look for photographs, or the temple, which is the other thing you get, which is that small building just off to one side. Those are the only actual buildings on this 2,700-acre estate that you can go back and say, James Madison was here. Okay, this was here when he was alive during the period of his retirement and or before. Everything else is either just ruins in the ground, you know, foundations, or primarily DuPont-era additions.
Yeah.
So most of the other buildings that you see around the estate are from that era. That is
That's just striking.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate for us. You know, there's a lot of other historic sites that have their outbuildings.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
I'm thinking Monticello. They've got Mulberry Row, right?
They do, but a lot of their buildings are also ruins there.
Okay.
But things like Stratford Hall, they have a lot of their outbuildings, you know.
That was Washington's boyhood? Was it?
That was Robert E. Lee's.
Robert E. Lee's, excuse me, I misspoke.
Yeah, in Westmoreland County.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of these Tidewater plantations have their outbuildings. Unfortunately for us, you know, we go through a series of owners through from the Madisons to the DuPonts, and they change, also make their mark on the landscape and change things. So one of the later owners, probably in the 1850s, tore down all of those outbuildings that I am now so carefully reconstructing. Mm-hmm. They tore them down and moved slave quarters so they were away from the mansion because they didn't want them to, you know, to disturb their view at the time. And you think the agricultural buildings were used very... they were used a lot, so they, you know, declined rapidly, and those don't survive either. So we take our cues from the ground and the archaeology, and we're, you know, looking at documents. But yeah, most of our buildings are DuPont. We have a few that are in between, like our, I think it's probably 1850s bowling alley that unfortunately...
Wait.
Yeah.
1850s bowling alley.
Yeah, we have a bowling alley here at Montpelier.
From the 1850s.
I think it's probably 1850s. Maybe... at the latest 1870s.
Okay, so this is definitely not Madison era.
Definitely not Madison.
And yet part of history because, forgive me, when I think of bowling, I think of, you know, bowling for dollars. I think of, you know, people with, you know, automatic pin resetters, but I'm guessing they didn't have those back
No,
then.
It probably would have been an enslaved child resetting the pins until, you know, the end of slavery, and then the DuPonts had a hired servant. But yeah, it's one lane. It's probably the oldest private bowling alley in the South.
Okay, where is this on the property?
It is located kind of behind the mansion, kind of near our walking trails. So it's close to the mansion, next to the garden, but you normally wouldn't see it unless you walked over there.
Okay, I've never noticed it before. I mean, is this actually an enclosed building that's
still
can walk in there and you can recognize this
as a
bowling?
Yeah, there's a lane. There's a bowling lane in the building.
Okay, at some point I'm coming over and you're going to show me the bowling. Okay.
And the problem with our bowling alley is, unfortunately, it just got struck by a tree.
Okay.
During an ice storm we had.
This is another part of my job.
Uh-huh. It's disaster.
Oh, my goodness.
Disaster repair. So, yeah, we'll be getting hopefully some insurance money to fix that back up. But the roof was damaged in that storm.
And again, this is not the Madison era, but it is part of the history of this site. So have you made a decision that you're going to save that bowling alley?
Definitely. It's a very important building. Again, you know, like you said, it's not Madison era, but it's significant in its own right. It could be the oldest private lane in the South.
Wow.
And that's something. I mean, that's pretty important for us. And it's just a cool part of history. You know, who else has a bowling alley that old?
Understood. But let's get back to the temple.
Yeah.
You mentioned the temple, and it is, to a great extent, the symbol of Montpelier.
Yeah.
It's the logo of Montpelier. Tell us a little bit about that. It was based upon the Temple of Vesta, the Vestal Virgins, was it?
Yeah, so at the time period when it was built, the 1810s, Madison and Jefferson were thinking very carefully about the ideas of liberty, and the Temple of Vesta held the kind of flame of the Republic in ancient Rome. So it's this kind of, it's a temple form, kind of like a Roman temple. And these things were often found in English gardens, kind of as ornamental garden follies. But it harkens back to the idea of liberty and kind of the Republic in general. But ours is actually also, you know, not just a decoration or decorative landscape feature. There's a 25-foot deep brick-lined ice house below it.
Which I only learned of several years after I started coming here regularly, and I thought to myself, that is just a cool bit of hidden history.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so there's you can't see it walking up to the temple, but there's a little hatch, and there was a doorway on the side. We do have an ice pond. The DuPonts kind of enlarged it and lined it with concrete, but that's the original ice pond, actually right outside the building that we're sitting in right now.
Right, it's beautiful.
Yeah, and so in the winter, ice would be cut off that pond, taken by wagon by enslaved workers, and they would take it up to the temple and drop the ice in there. And there are documents that talk about the Madisons having ice throughout the summer. So things like Dolly Madison's famous oyster ice cream and punch and parties and stuff like that, that's what it would be used for. So it's very practical, but above this ice house is this really decorative neoclassical garden temple that is a landscape feature. And also Madison, we think, maybe Had the idea of being able to come out and sit underneath it. There's a nice breeze that you often get in that spot, so he could write there. And it is kind of also a show of his wealth. When you drive up to the house, it's right to the left of the mansion, and you can see it very clearly. And not many people would have a garden folly in their backyard. So it's definitely a show of wealth as well.
Absolutely. And it used to be connected to the main house by a pine alley, right?
Yeah, the pine alley, which is actually something that the archaeologists are looking for right now. We have one photograph of it when it's kind of overgrown in the 1870s, I believe. But we also have lots of documentary evidence on it, and the archaeology team is finding the original planting holes for these pine trees. So it's two rows of pine trees that would direct, it's a forced perspective, so it directs your eyesight from the corner of the mansion down to the temple through this kind of row of pine trees. And it's going to be really cool when we are able to restore that.
Very good. So assuming that some angel comes forward with a significant amount of money, the next major project after the South Yard is going to be the temple restoration.
Yep.
And then I'm sure some other projects will crop up.
Yeah, we'll find some other stuff.
You'll find some other stuff to do. Great. Well, it sounds to me, Jen, like you've got one of the coolest jobs around. Any final thoughts before we finish up our discussion today?
No, I love my job, and I love being able to preserve history here at Montpelier, and it's always fun to do the hands-on stuff. So we're very lucky to be able to do that at Montpelier.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your experiences with us today. So once again, I find myself in one of my favorite little rooms with one of my favorite people. I almost said one of my favorite little people, but you're actually rather tall.
Yeah, so also, that doesn't quite hold
up. It would have been a nice parallel construction there. I'm here with Emily Voss. And she is the quiz gal. And the little room reference, though, is relevant because during a recent break, we were talking about one of our favorite authors, Edgar Allan Poe, and our favorite stories. And one of them involved a very little room. What was that story?
The Cask of Amontillado.
Cask of Amontillado.
A classic Poe tale.
Classic Poe tale.
And super creepy.
It is extremely super creepy, and I'm hesitant to give away the ending because I'm sure there are people out there, even though it was written, 150 years ago or more.
But he holds up, you know.
He does hold up.
He holds up.
I will simply give the recommendation without a spoiler that it involves a little room and a huge dose of creepiness, and it's one of Poe's best. So do it. Enjoy it. And now do we have a quiz contestant? Is someone?
Yeah.
Oh, who do we have?
This is Miranda from Savannah, Georgia.
From Savannah.
I love Savannah.
I love Savannah too. I'm sure you've seen Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, right, Savannah? Oh, Savannah, excuse me, Miranda.
I believe you have to refer to it as the book if you are from Savannah.
Oh, the book. You've read the book, haven't you, Miranda?
Yes.
How accurate was that? Did that strike you? Did it ring true as a resident of Savannah?
I think so. Yeah.
So those people there are kind of kooky. Is that it?
Yeah. I would 100% agree with that.
Good. Well, and they also have really good food, and they have lovely Spanish moss and beautiful architecture.
The wrought iron. Love it.
The wrought iron. Yeah, so we're big fans. Okay, well, then I think you're our first Savannah contestant. So I'm tempted to ask Emily to go easy on you, but I don't think she's constitutionally capable of that.
Ha ha.
I'm just rolling today.
Yeah,
what do
no
you
kidding.
Got, quiz gal?
All righty. So today I have a question for you about the Bill of Rights. So, okay. I'm going to explain this question a little bit just to make sure everybody understands it, but it's a good one. All right. So, name the three states that did not ratify the entire Bill of Rights until 1939. So, I'm going to give you four, and I need you to tell me which three of the four did not ratify the Bill of Rights until 1939.
Until 1939. Okay.
They were late to the party.
Okay.
All right. So, A, Massachusetts, B, New Jersey, C, Connecticut, or D, Georgia. So remember, I need three of the four. One of those did ratify in the in the 18th century.
That would be the way to answer is to figure out which.
So you can work your way backwards. Who didn't do it?
Right, but if you figure out who did do it, which one of those, that's the way I would think of it, which one of those do you think did ratify the entire Bill of Rights before 1939?
Did or did not? Did.
So yeah, Stuart wants you to think of the one that did ratify back in the 18th century,
right?
To reveal the other three that were late to the party.
Okay.
Connecticut
is the one that you think did ratify them all.
Yes.
Okay. And therefore, the other three did not ratify until 1939. Is that your guess?
Yes.
Okay. Why are you picking Connecticut as the one that did ratify before 1939?
It just sounds like one of those. That's one of the original ones that would.
But so were Massachusetts and New Jersey.
Yeah.
Even Georgia.
I guess.
We're profiling states here, Stuart.
Is that what we're doing? We're profiling states. All right, final answer then.
Okay, yeah, I'll just go with that.
I wish I could help you, but I'm looking at Emily. I have no idea what you're driving.
It's a difficult question.
Okay, go on.
So it was, in fact, New Jersey ratified originally back in the 18th century.
Right.
So the latecomers were Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Georgia. And the reason that they didn't ratify was that they didn't have to. By the time Virginia ratified, it was 3/4 approval was necessary, and the other three didn't have to, so they didn't.
That has got to be the single most difficult question that has ever been on this quiz. I had no idea, but now that you explain it, it makes perfect sense. Why would you bother to ratify?
You don't have to.
If you don't have to ratify. Except for the fact that it's the Bill of Rights.
It's the Bill of Rights, and yeah, come on now.
So
but it's true.
What was magical about 1939? Why did they do it then?
You know, I'm not sure what was the magical ingredient that made it 1939.
Okay. So once
we'll
again,
have to go look that up.
Georgia, Connecticut, and
Massachusetts
simply were late to the party.
Yep.
Virginia was the last necessary state to ratify, and so they said, oh, okay, well, it's ineffective.
We're good.
we're good. Okay, well, that's fantastic. That's a really great question. But, I'm going to tell you what, though. Miranda, I think this was so hard that we're going to give you a T-shirt anyway.
Yeah, you deserve a T-shirt.
You deserve a T-shirt. Absolutely. So send us a message on Facebook. Go to Your Weekly Constitutional on Facebook. Send us a message. Give us your snail mail address and your T-shirt size, and we will put one in the mail to you along with a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
Yay.
Okay. Thanks for playing, Miranda.
Thank you.
Absolutely, and thank you. That was a great question, Emily, and a great explanation. So thank you very much.
All right, Stuart. Well, just remember, we the people includes girls, too.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Jennifer Glass, the Director of Architecture and Historic Preservation at Montpelier, who told us all about her ongoing efforts to resurrect the Madison's home. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.